You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Star Trek is a vision.
Great storytelling.
My favorite TV show of all time.
I really love it, and it's so much fun.
Join our crew aboard Earth Station Trek for your regular podcast escape into the Trekverse.
Make it so.
Let's see what's out there.
Wait a minute. I thought we all agreed to say make it so.
No, let's go. It's fun.
But make it so is iconic. It's classic.
It's too iconic.
So we're all going to do make it so?
No.
This is full-scale war against the terrible enemy that modern man has never forfeited.
Evidently, you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we are celebrating our sixth anniversary on this episode of Monster Attack. Can you believe it has been 6 years already? So I decided to go back to the very roots of Monster Attack for this episode and invite someone that we haven't seen in quite a long time. I don't know, how long has it been? Years and years and years? Mark Maddox is with us on this anniversary episode. He was right there in the beginning. We could not do a sixth anniversary show without Mark. So welcome aboard, Mark. No, it hasn't been years. It's only been a few weeks, but you know. He's trying to whistle and he can't.
I'm trying to. No, I'm not trying to whistle. I'm trying to do the, you know, the sonar. Not that that movie had it, but
the
movie we're going to do. It's been, God, I don't know.
Since
I
think Monsterama, it's been at least probably. Sort of around that time period. Yeah.
Has it? Yeah. It's been a while. We got one, you know, that even Jim could drag me out with all the stuff I'm doing, drag me out of my studio and get me to come and do it. You know, Jim and I, we talk about some films about, you know, at the level that they
That's
are,
right.
the level of importance and stuff. And I think that this one would, for a lot of people, classify in their top 10 science
fiction
films.
Oh, I think so.
Films.
Yeah, absolutely. And
there's a lot of people that put it as number one, number five, whatever. I put it easily in the top 10. And matter of fact,
and that's high praise for Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. I'll tell you, folks, this is going to be a fun show.
God, I love it. I love it. And push everything else out of the way and just go.
That's
for that
right.
Now,
we've already done a show on that, actually. So
it's Kubrick's best film. But the thing is, you know, when it's also, if it isn't the most important science fiction book.
Yeah.
Of all time, it's in the top five. It has
Absolutely.
To be just by its sheer. I mean, it was. I learned the definition of science fiction from my mother and my brother telling me who Jules Verne was. Now, it wasn't with this film. It was with the Czech film, An Invention for Destruction, aka The Fabulous World of Jules Verne. But I was stunned by it, and then the whole idea of science fiction being so old, science fiction taking place back where, you know, in the Victorian era, and then to have this movie come out. And I remember I hadn't seen it. I didn't even know that Disney had done a movie like this. And then one night on the Wonderful World of Disney, they were doing one of their regular shows, and they put an ad on, and it says coming 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. This is about 1970 when they did
71.
A re-release. 71. And I was like,
now was that the episode where they showed the whole thing on the TV show, or did they break it up?
It wasn't an episode. This was the theater.
During
the show, they did an ad for it being at
That's
the movie
right.
theater.
Yeah, it was 71. I remember that. I was a junior in high school because I saw it on the second release. Of course, it was made the year I was born, so my mom and dad had seen it when it was re-released in '63. They came out with it again in another tour of the movie theaters. It was sort of like, no, you've got to go see this movie. Of course, I had just been introduced to monster movies. You know, I'd only been, you know, I've been really getting into them for the last 2 years. And I'm like your story, my mom was a huge Jules Verne fan. My grandfather was a huge Jules Verne fan. He got my mom into it, and he would read them, my mom and her brother and sister, he would read them a chapter out of a Jules Verne book every night before they go into bed. So that's how that's how she got exposed to the novel. So I knew a lot about Jules Verne and could not wait to see this movie. When it was released.
I was surprised, and I didn't know how I was going to see it because my dad wasn't home. He was off in Vietnam, and my mother didn't drive. And so there was kids. I mean, our aunts took us around and stuff like that when she needed to shop and stuff. But I wasn't in a movie theater for about 2 to 3 years, which, until my dad came home, and then we moved back on to a base. And then ended up finally going to the movie theater again. And then they showed it on the base, which, by the way, I wanted to bring this little side note up real quick. This has nothing to do with the movie we're talking about, but that story there of me being out of the movie theater for those years, the first movie I saw when we came back and finally got to a movie theater was What's Up,
Doc. Oh, nice.
And great I wanted to, yeah, it's a great movie. And I wanted to say that we're here at the show. We're really sorry about the loss of Peter Bogdanovich with all of his, his big incredible films. That string there that he had in the early 70s was tremendous.
Oh, he was the top director for sure during that time period.
And a great historian too. So we miss him. Anyway, so Jules Verne is the man. Victorian science fiction. Him and H.G. Wells. It was already cemented with Jules Verne, but then it was also cemented even more firm by H.G. Wells with his even wilder science fiction stories. Yeah. I finally got to see this movie at this little shoebox based theater that I love tremendously, where I saw a lot of great films that we all love to this day. But my dad's like, "Oh, that's coming. I'm going to go too." And it was rare to get my dad to go to the movies. Yeah. And it was especially rare to get him to go see science fiction movies. I mean, he would go, "Oh, Planet of the Apes double feature. I'm going." Really? Really, Dad? You're going to that? Or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He had to go see that too. But there was stuff. Anyway, so we went to see it. Now, something strange. I'm going to say this, and it's going to sound kind of weird, but the first time I saw it, I didn't like it.
Well, that sounds weird to me, but
it is weird, isn't it? It's weird to me to say it too. I think that I expected something. I mean, yes, I could see the polish of the film and everything like that. I think it at the time for some reason. Well, it's a funny story. I went with my dad and two buddies, Joe Schmeltz, John Massimiani, and my dad took us, and he went to the theater, watched it too. We're close to the front row, and maybe it was the fact that we were kind of, cutting up and doing this and doing that and everything like that. And I ended up I think it broke interest in me. I've seen it before. Yeah. I've seen when you're watching a movie that you love and somebody comes in and they're half watching it and it breaks the intensity. And so here's the other thing that happened that was very funny. I think the guys that ran the base theater were not actual military personnel. They lived off the base because they never were in uniforms or anything like that. Right. They were just, I think they came in from off the base and they ran the theater. Old shoebox. We had our popcorn wasn't even given to us by a person across the counter. It was literally from a deposit machine, a machine that machine, but a deposit popcorn in a cup. And it was about the size of a large soda cup. Right. And so it was like 25 cents or something. So you do that and you go in there. So we came in, and I guess the theater hadn't been cleaned up from the day before or previously, and it was raining cats and dogs at the base. It was raining, pouring in, and water started coming in to the front of the theater where it sloped down to the front near the screen and started to fill up the front part of the theater. God. So we got these popcorn cups. And we started shaping them into the shape of the Nautilus and started pushing them out there. This lake literally formed in 30 minutes. And so we started pushing these things and we found more popcorn cups throughout the theater. And by the time the lights came up, when the movie was over, one of the guys came down and he saw all these boats floating you saw these boats floating in this pool at the front of the theater.
Anyway. Well, did you fashion them after the Nautilus of the novel or the Nautilus of the movie?
Well, we were watching the movie, okay. So it's sort of, well, we were, it was, yeah, I think Captain Nemo would look at this and go, you guys don't quit your day job. Yeah. But anyway, so some time goes by and I think I saw it once on television and then it came out on Disney VHS. I started borrowing a copy from the local library and I found myself almost putting it on a loop as a young man. I was putting it on a loop and I was watching it and I would get up really early in the morning before I went off to school. This is when I was in art school. I got up in the morning and I'd run it almost every morning for days on end and completely fell in love with it. And I think it was just, you know, it wasn't a thing. It was never a bad film. I was just being a kid at the time. And
well,
I think
could see that because I mean, when it was on, you know, in Wonderful World of Disney aired it first, they cut it up. They did it in a series, you know, they did it over a period of 4 weeks the first time, which was really weird. Plus, we had a black and white TV, so you lose a whole lot when you don't have it in color. And then especially I think it was, I forgot how many years it was before they finally figured out, okay, we'll find a way to get the network to extend our time. Because it was only an hour long show, if people remember.
Yes.
You know, so they could run its full, you know, it's an hour and a half film or a little more than an hour and a half, but to, you know, get a 2 hour time period or 2.5 hour time period for the commercials and all that, and then run it in its entirety. I think it was about like on the fourth screening on Wonderful World of Disney where they finally showed the whole movie complete that night. So that takes a lot out of a movie too, I think, when you have to wait every week for the next installment.
Well, I'm looking for technical specs here real quick. It's 2 hours and 7 minutes, the film.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of another film. Sorry.
It is a long, you're thinking of Frankenstein.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's 2 hours and 7 minutes. I'm sorry, guys. I've been working on about like three shows this week. So.
Well, the thing is with this movie, it's not an epic at the level of like Ben-Hur, but it does take place over a large course of time. And a lot of things happen in the film. And
they're very loyal to the book, so they get as much in there as they can.
Yeah. I could see that happening, what you're talking about with, and I think I remember finally they put it on like a regular night at the movies.
It was something. I can't remember if it was still on the Sunday night slot or not, but they accommodated it and were able to. Yeah. Of course, by then I had a color TV, so... It wasn't so bad.
It was one of those too, like when they put Mary Poppins on there. Right, I would have to say, for the most part, out of the early days of Disney, the first 20 years of their live action, that those two were probably the most popular films they ever did. Yeah, I still think they're their two best live action films. But yes, that was my story of watching it, but then I really fell in love with it. I was even watching it again yesterday and telling Linda, every time you get to that part where Kirk Douglas looks like he's going to barf when he's being told, you know, saute of undead octopus
or whatever.
Oh, that's
a great scene.
Or whatever. And I'm like, you know what's funny is that food doesn't sound bad at all. None of it
does. Not anymore, but back then it
was. I think we're in a... Back then it was meat and potatoes kind of stuff. I mean, it was made for... But I honestly think nowadays, when I was like, I wonder if they could do that. I mean, some of that stuff, if any of that would actually be done. And you know... I mean, it's like, I mean, you go into a restaurant, I've seen people order shark to eat and stuff. It's not a octopus and stuff like that.
Well, people order octopus now too. I mean, you know,
that scene makes me hungry every time I watch it.
No, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. Yeah. Cause as a kid, it was like sort of, the only thing that wasn't grotesque in there, you know, cause everything folks, again, spoiler alerts, I think we could spoil this one because it's such a well-known story. Nemo, everything they ate, everything they used all came from the sea. And the seaweed for the cigars. I mean, that was the only thing that wasn't really sort of like as a kid going, it's like, oh, okay, I can see that. You know, but nowadays at this age, and we're sort of used to being able to eat some of that weird stuff. It's like, yeah, okay, that's not so bad. Yeah, I can see that.
Well, given the year that it is, you know, we need to start getting used to Soylent Greens and its food from under the earth. Wink, 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 wink. By the way, a friend of mine posted the other day, there is Soylent is in Publix.
Oh, is it?
Yes, wow. There's. He sent me pictures of two or three jars, plant supplement or
plant-based food. Oh man, that's great.
Yeah, plant-based food. Wink, yeah. Wink. Yeah, why? I don't know why they got a portrait of Edward G. Robinson on though. No telling. Anyway, so this film is a tour de force. I have to say. You know, we got all these great movies of science fiction from the 1950s. My personal favorite film almost of all time is the 1951 version of The Thing.
Yes.
Not a big budget, not a huge budget, a modest budget, but so well done. You've got the George Pal movie. Yep. You got War of the Worlds, which, by the way, won the special effect for 54 and Oscars. And then this one won the next year for 55 Oscars. So it's neat to see those two films. Right. One an H.G. Wells origin story, and then a Jules Verne. And I think that when I watch this film, it's like, because there's something that makes it hold up better than all of those films. Everybody's going to go, hey, you better watch it.
Yeah.
And it's Victorian science fiction. It already came on the scene. It was already past anything that they did that was which was super fantastic for people in the Victorian era. They could do it with us and we would go, boy, that's really cool. You know, it's sort of like in a way later like they did with Wild Wild West.
Absolutely. I mean,
it was yes, if we show you a spaceship from the present day, is it, are people going to scoff at it 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now? You know, there's a possibility. With this movie, everything would already have been, it's already in the past. Yeah, it's retro science fiction already. And because of it, the artists go nuts. The art directors go nuts. The painters and the technicians and the set builders and everything went berserk.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, this started opening up a whole world, a whole genre of steampunk. You know, I mean, that's why movies like this still play so well. Because, I mean, you've got a huge...
Yeah, I've never been...
You know, I love the whole steampunk genre. I think it's great.
I like... You know, this is where I've got to be a stick.
Yeah, you're going to be the stick in the mud, aren't you?
Well, let me do this, because I usually am not a stick in the mud, but I get tired of that term. I was told why, because cyberpunk was the word. Yeah. That, and then it goes back, and I said, that's the tail wagging the dog. This is Victorian science fiction. And then there's a lot of Victorian science fiction. Everybody goes, oh, it's steampunk. Like, no, it's not steampunk. It's Victorian science fiction.
Steampunk is
something they added onto it later. Steampunk
took from Victorian fiction. You know, the Victorian science fiction. So, I mean, it's like, I mean, they are two different animals. But, you know, I think movies like this will never get tiring. I think this movie still plays well. You know, how many years later, it is still... And a fun movie to watch, and very engrossing. I mean, I have as much fun as a kid.
I watched it yesterday, you know, on the big ass TV. I don't have to beep ass or not bleep it or whatever, but big ass TV is the brand name.
Yeah.
And with the Blu-ray, and I've watched this film probably three times in the last year or so, maybe four times in the last 2 years, but I'm even more amazed as I'm seeing more and more details of the level of work that the technicians put into this movie. I mean, there's like aquariums in Nemo's main whatever the main room where the organ is in there that he plays music and all that, and the big window. I mean, the window itself is amazing. The handle that opens up the window. But then I started noticing stuff this time. I'm like, every square inch of that set has got something going on it. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, Queen of Blood where there's, you know, just some nails into some cardboard on the wall. I mean, I love that movie too, yeah. But it's like one of those where it's like, ooh, they made him such minimal.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of bunks and there's the exercise thing was a rubber hose, you know, that was nailed to a wall or something, you know, and in this thing, every square inch, I mean, Nemo lifts the top of some kind of an aquarium and I'm just looking at all the ornate paintings that are running down the side of the aquarium, and then there's another aquarium off to the other side that's on a pedestal with all this. I'm like, my God, who, you know, where did they get all this? Or is any of this store bought? Is it all invented? No matter what way it's done, it's magnificent. Yeah, yeah. The deep sea diving suits look functional. The exterior of the sub is absolutely gorgeous. The only thing that I think this is one of the reasons that we begat a neat looking time machine in the movie Time Machine. I mean, they could boil it all down into something about the size of a VW, but with 20,000 leagues, I mean, all the sets, the rooms, the lobby, the map room, Ned's quarters, Nemo's quarters, all that stuff is amazing. Yeah. It's like a living painting. So, all right, I'll shut up for a minute. I'm tired. Go ahead.
I look at every time I see this movie, I look at how it's influenced other films that have come out since then. I mean, I have to believe that this film influenced Irwin Allen and his view of the sea view for Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Oh, yeah. I believe that.
You know, not only the big window, you know, the big observation window, which was pretty much unheard of in submarines, you know, during the 50s. You know, it just so many things that came out of this. The one I like the way that they updated the story. You know, the purists are going to say, well, it wasn't exactly like the novel. Yeah, there were some changes they made. In the book, it was it was a battery-powered submarine, an old-style battery-powered. But in this one, we were just a couple of years past discovering atomic energy. So they made it an atomic submarine. Of course, our first U.S. submarine that was atomic-powered was nicknamed the Nautilus. This movie, or after the Jules Verne book and movie, like you said, there's just some cool things of this. I mean, I loved going to Walt Disney World and seeing a reckoning of the organ, and the whole Nemo ride was a blast because it was almost like stepping into the movie set. You know, at the time they had that.
It doesn't exist
anymore.
No,
I know they replaced it, unfortunately, but.
And for unnecessary reasons,
They brought another attraction in or something, but it's like, how do you replace
it? Well, it was also, too, there was some parts that they needed to repair, somebody dropped the ball on it. But I do know that, I guess, at least in the 50s and 60s, maybe, out in Disneyland, they had a bunch of the sets out there for people to go
through. Oh, they did. That's where all the original stuff, and even the original organ, which is still around somewhere.
Yeah.
It may still be at Disneyland.
It should be.
But, there's so much of the story to like. I think the major question that most people I know asked when they first saw this film for the very first time was, did Kirk Douglas really sing in this movie? The answer is, yes, he did.
He not only sang,
but he also had to learn to play that tenor guitar, which, okay, for the purists out there who are the spoil sports, to go, well, here's something, that guitar hadn't even been invented when this took place. It's like, you know what? Go lock yourself in your room and, you know, play on the computer because we don't want to hear you. The tenor guitar had not been invented yet, but I think it was the music director, taught him how to play that guitar and do some of the tricks he did with it, and actually coached him in singing the song. So, yes, that is Kirk Douglas.
If I kissed her and held her tenderly.
So,
and we had a musical interlude on the show, first time ever.
He was really singing, so, you know, Kirk.
Yeah, you could tell it was him. I mean, but it was fun. It was also a break between, you know, there was a conference just before that, and then he goes out and he does the song and all that kind of stuff. And I think at first I'm like, okay, it's very Hollywood and all that kind of stuff. But then I realized later, it's like you've got the severity of the thing, and like we're finished. Yeah. And everybody knows the basics of this movie. If you don't, and I'm spoiling it for you.
Oh, no, we already said we're spoiling it. Yeah.
No. But I'm actually going to enjoy it when you write me back. You bastard. What do you think you do? Anyway, for some reason, the shipping lanes are being attacked by what they believe is a sea monster, beast from under the ocean. And I get the feeling they're not attacking just general ships. They're only attacking warships, which is Nemo's MO.
We're pretending to be merchant ships, but we're secretly carrying arms as well. So,
right. Yes. And so, you know, but there's this back and forth, and they get these scientists played by Paul Lucas and his assistant, Peter Lorre, to go out with the ship. Shipping has come to almost a standstill. So they convince Paul Lucas and Peter Lorre to go with them on a thing where they can, you know, get a person of scientific knowledge of the ocean to keep an eye out and see if they spot it, that maybe he can give them some kind of clue. And then it looks like, you know, they're getting tired and the captain doesn't believe in all this stuff either. And then all of a sudden you see a ship off the shore. Now they go from him saying that to the song, and then we get into the big, really first action serious set piece again, of the movie. Yeah, and you got a ship that's blowing up and stuff out in the ocean. They go over there, and then they see this thing in the water, and they it starts to leave. Well, they start shelling it, and then it turns around, comes back, and rams the ship. And it doesn't. I don't think it sinks the ship. I think it cripples it.
Yeah, but right. It doesn't totally sink it. That's right.
Yeah, Ned and the professor and Peter Lorre, they all fall into the water, and then in this fog later, whatever, they come across the what they think is the monster there in the water, and go on board, and that's when you find out it's a submarine full of guys, and it's headed by this guy named Captain Nemo, who is sick and tired of. The way the world is run, and tired of the warmongering and everything going on, and he destroys warships. We find out later why, but everybody in this film, is really well cast. I remember at some points in time thinking that Kirk Douglas was too, happy-go-lucky kind of guy and everything. But I think I think. As the years gone on, I've really grown fond of that character and everything. And James Mason, while I don't think he is portrayed exactly as he is in the book, is still an excellent character.
Oh, I think so. It's interesting. One of his leading contenders, the one guy that auditioned for this that almost got the part, was Gregory Peck. Mm. But Richard Fleischer wanted James Mason. He had him in mind from the very beginning, I think he made the right choice. I don't think I could see Gregory Peck doing this. I mean, he's a great actor, but no. I don't know if he could have pulled it off like Mason did. Mason was he's sort of understated. He came across as the kind of guy that could invent something like this device and do some of the things that Nemo did.
Is that maybe one of the reasons why the next year, or was it afterwards that Moby Dick came out? Did Moby Dick come out after?
Right around this time period.
I think Gregory Peck could have done it, but you know, a lot of people, it's not as much as it used to be. Now it's getting more love. Moby Dick from the 50s was kind of picked on because of his performance. Now I'm going to say something about Gregory Peck. Gregory Peck is like Robert Redford, who spoilers, there's a movie in the last decade he did where Robert Redford wasn't a good guy. I won't say which one it is, either, but my brother and my mother aren't talking to each other when she spilled the beans on what he was doing in a certain film. Anyway, but Gregory Peck always played good guys.
Yeah,
he was always a good guy. So to see him either gray or dark was tough. And I think that's the reason his Captain Ahab gets a bad rap.
I thought he made a great Ahab. It's still my favorite rendition of the movie. Is that version?
I think so too. And I think that because enough years have gone by where people don't expect a person to always be a certain thing. I think that Gregory Peck's performance has risen for a lot of people. I think he's totally fine. He looks like him. I could see him. I could see him playing Nemo. I think the thing is, back then, I don't know. I think they probably thought the audience isn't going to believe that he's villainous enough. I mean,
that brings up a thing. I still think I don't see Nemo as being an Ahab type character. Yes, he was. You know, Nemo was more, in my mind, was more like, and it's a weird comparison to make, like a Dr. Frankenstein played by Peter Cushing type character, just so obsessed with his mission, with his personal mission, that, you know, because when he's confronted confronted with the fact, says, hey, you're murdering a whole lot of people. And he's saying, no, but, you know, sort of like the end justifies the means. Type thing. Yes. And that, you know, that's sort of how Cushing used to play Frankenstein. That's what I liked about how he played that. And it really set the table for a film that has nothing to do with anything with Monster Attack, but just one of my all time favorite films, was a character that he plays in a film called The Blue Max, where he plays this general, and they're very similar characters in some ways.
I was watching 20,000 Leagues. Like I said, I was getting ready to hit the hay last night, and I just turned on, I think it was HBO Max, went to their Turner Classic Movies hub, and I put on A Star Is Born, and it starts right off at the beginning with him being abusive drunk and everything like that. And Mason he can be a good guy, but he can also be a bad guy. He can be moderately rotten. He can be horrifically rotten. He can be bizarrely rotten. I mean, look at him in Lolita. You look at him in some of these films, and he's really look at him in Salem's Lot.
Oh, God, that was again, another great performance by him. I really loved the character he played in that.
The master, you know, but he sort of... he really was great. I mean, I know, there was some women that was like, oh my God, what a great matinee idol. And then you look at him in some things like, where he played, Rommel, and everything. I mean, he was great. He was a great actor. And Disney, you know, it had to be a strange thing for them to go, we're finally doing a full-blown, very expensive live-action picture. We are known for animation and cartoons, and we're going to make a serious movie. And to bring on board Kirk Douglas and James Mason, you know, it's like, wow. Now, I don't know how famous Mason was at the point. I mean, Star Is Born was there.
Oh, no, he was well-known. He was well-known when he did this film.
Yeah, well-known, but famous. I mean, Kirk Douglas was already like...
Douglas was the highest paid actor on the film. He made $150,000 for making this movie. That was huge money for back then. I mean, you know, for it's just unbelievable money. And nobody came close to making that much.
It's funny too, because he's so $150,000 made him very energized.
Yes.
In this movie, he is very physical, very, you know, energetic, very upbeat. Even when he's mad or when something bad has gone on, he's upbeat. When he goes to the island take some notes and collect samples, and it's really for him to escape, and those natives start chasing him back. I love it. He's running down that
beach. It's almost humorous.
Which, by the way, is humorous. I mean, it's like, but he's running full get out. I love it. He runs and jumps in the boat, and the natives are almost to the little rowboat, and he starts rowing, and the oars don't go in the water, so he falls backwards into Peter Lorre.
The story behind that? There's a reason that happened. It was actually an accident that Fleischer liked so much he left it in the film. But they had weighted that skiff down for particular scenes, and they forgot to put the sandbags in it for this scene. So the boat was actually sitting up higher in the water than Douglas realized. So when he goes to row, the oars don't even hit the water, and boom, he goes,
That was funny.
And so Fleischer saw the take, and they were going to reshoot it, and he says, no, I like that. Let's leave it in there. It sort of works.
Why not? It was great. A happy accident.
It was hilarious.
Yeah, he's very physical. He Shatners it a lot with the shirt being off and everything. Yeah. But you know, if I was built that well, I probably want to do that too. The interplay between him. I've never seen Peter Lorre play this kind of a person in a film. I mean, I think of him in M. Yeah. I think of him in the Roger Corman movies. I think of him in Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon, where he's, you know, weaselly and everything. But in this movie, he's a completely decent
yeah person. I mean, he's almost like the character he played in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea in the film. But in that was a very understated character for him.
Well, but in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, he played a he was pretty much you know, he almost reminded me of just any realistic scientist.
True.
My uncle used to say this. He goes, you think scientists worry about their clothes and stuff like that? That's why Einstein's hair is stuck in the air. You're worrying about that crap. And you look at Peter Lorre, and he's certainly not a matinee idol, but he's playing it like somebody who's thinking technically. This movie, he is the assistant. He's not as smart as the guy that he is in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, but he's nice, and he's kind of lovable.
Oh, yeah.
And the way him and Kirk Douglas get along. Now, I do love the fact that at one point we can see him be a little brutal, where, you know, Kirk Douglas punches him in the face because he said he was spying on him. And then he goes, I thought we were friends. And he goes, oh, it's okay. And then Kirk Douglas sticks out that big giant chin of his and goes, it's okay. I'll make it up to you. You can hit me. Go ahead. And he sticks his chin and he goes, you can't miss. And that chin looked like it grew like twice size, like they inflated absolutely. It. And then Peter Lorre goes over and hits him in the stomach.
Yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah.
I thought that was absolutely. And then you can see Peter Lorre would be mean if he needed to.
Well, not mean. He outsmarted him. You know, it's like, okay, now we're really friends. You caught me off guard with your punch, and I caught you off guard with mine. You know.
But when he says, now we are friends, and he says it like that, it's sort of like, yeah, you can see that, that this guy is no patsy.
Oh, no.
He's not a patsy.
No.
But anyway, so all that stuff's great, the interplay between those two. And I think that Paul Lucas is really good as the guy stuck in the middle. Yeah. I don't disagree with most of the stuff he does in the film. And when we go to the big reveal here of Nemo, when the argument really gets as heated as it can be, Nemo's just destroyed a warship. It's sinking to the bottom, then it blows up, and it damages the Nautilus. But you know, Paul Lucas is looking at James Mason and going, you know what, you cannot justify this and all kind of stuff. And we find out the reason that he's doing this stuff. And he has shown that these guys are, first off, they've got slavery going on. They're beating guys with whips and all this kind of stuff. And they're selling munitions. And when the ship sinking to the bottom, he goes, you know, I was part of that group, and they wanted to know, you know, about the secrets of my submarine and my abilities and all the other knowledge I've got. And he goes, oh, and I wouldn't tell them they tortured my wife and young son to death. That is the core of who Nemo
is. And Star Trek fans, guess where they were at? They were at Rurapente.
Yesterday Linda was in the other room and she heard the guy go Rurapente, and she goes, Rurapente? I said, yeah, that's where they got. Now, I don't know if Rurapente was in the book.
I'm not sure either, but that's where Star Trek got the idea to call the Klingon.
Oh, it's prison. An homage.
An homage.
Yeah, it's perfect. And to me, it's great. Oh, yeah. I mean, once again, it's paying homage. I mean, somebody who thought, Nick Meyer was involved with that. You only know how much he loves, older literature and stuff. So, does it justify what Nemo's doing? If you had a guy going around destroying anybody that tried to make work, which the only way they could back then was on the ocean, there was no flight, there was no guys dropping troops into other countries from the air or anything like that. But for have a guy going around doing that, it does raise a gray area, even in the minds of people that would consider themselves decent. It's like, if this guy could stop war.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, by taking out some of these ships, would that be a bad thing? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that is the age old question that Vern was totally opposed to warfare. It appears in a lot of his books, especially again, we'll see it again in the sequel, Mysterious Island. When we meet Nemo one more time, Yeah, I mean that's the whole point. You know, I think Nemo is a naive character in this, and thinking that that's all it would take to stop war, because it's not the arms that causes the war; it's the men. What did man do before they invented all these bombs and bullets and stuff like that? They found other ways to kill each other. You know, if it was sharpening swords, a stick, what's he going to do now? Blow up anything that's made out of sticks or whatever? I mean, it's like, you know, that was the one.
Yeah.
That's one of the dichotomies, I think, of Captain Nemo, was like, you know, it's not that easy. There's no easy solution to this. He's acting purely on emotion because of what happened to his wife and son.
And near the end of the film, we get a feeling that there is the slimmest possibility that he will share his stuff with the world if they do it. Even then, I'm watching and going, I wouldn't believe the world would be ready for what he's got to give them. Now, you said that they did nuclear. One thing I liked about it is they hinted at nuclear, but they never said.
Well, no, they never said it outright. It was just some kind of force of energy that Nemo had come up with. So, but it was sort of implied.
It's interesting to me how it reminds me, in a way, and I'm going to look the date up on this, when Morbius is showing Leslie Nielsen and his gang of people their energy, the Krell energy supply. It reminds me of that a little bit. I'm going to look that up real quick and see which one came first, the chicken or the egg.
Very close.
Forbidden Planet. IMDb. Well, man, like I said, let's see, 56, the same year as Moby Dick. Moby Dick came out afterwards, so I guess maybe Gregory Peck had a hankering to, hey, I can't play Nemo, maybe I can play Ahab.
Could be.
But but they show the energies. Now in this one, it's so cool because you go in to the room where there's all these little spheres in the wall, but they're glass bubbles. What I like is they've got that old age sort of thing with old windows where down in the corner of a window, there's that sort of ring old glass. Where they pulled it away and the thing left a mark there. I mean, they weren't able to do like we can now make a perfect sheet of glass. They're in there in that. I thought that was such a nice touch. And then they open up this hatchway and he puts Professor Aronnax, Paul Lucas, in this giant head get up so he can look in at the force that's in there. And I thought that was really well done. I don't know. I'm trying to think of other stuff in the movie. Let's think of what else.
I'll throw some trivia at folks there. It's interesting that Richard Fleischer was selected as the director, and it surprised a lot of people. I was too young to know what was going on in production. I wasn't even born when they were in pre-production on this. But when people heard Fleischer was selected by Disney to direct this big epic that they were going to do, they were all surprised because Richard's father, Max Fleischer, was like Walt Disney's main competitor. And
they had worked together, I think, at first, and then went separate ways.
So when Max Fleischer was approached by the media and stuff back then, saying, "Hey, you know, your son's working for Walt Disney. What do you think of that?" He says, "I think he picked the right guy to direct his film," because originally this was going to be an animated movie. Walt Disney had conceived this as an animated motion picture. They did the test cells, when they were drawing out the concept for the film, one of the artists said, "Hey, this is too good to be a cartoon animated. We need to do this as live action." And they convinced Walt Disney to consider live action.
That's
and
wonderful.
He said, "Yeah, you're right. This needs to be a live action film."
That's great. Although I would be fascinated to see any stuff that was related to the animated.
Wouldn't that
film?
Be cool? I don't know if any of that stuff's still around. Yeah, who knows?
I can't imagine they would have gotten rid of it. It seemed like Walt and
probably
his
some collectors got
everything.
It.
Everything.
Yeah. Or somebody,
yeah.
But $9 million—a $9 million budget for back then—that's a lot of money for a movie.
And it's all on the screen.
And it was the third. It was the third highest grossing film of the year for that.
Do you know what it made? I mean, probably.
Initially $25 million in the first year off a $9 million investment. So that was it. Was the third
9, 18?
Yeah, was it?
That means it got real close to being. Yes, I mean, three times its budget. I don't know if that was the same back then.
Not quite as much. I mean, the marketing wasn't as, you know, didn't cost as much as it does nowadays. But, yeah, it was a huge hit.
So what
it
they
was
would
a huge
do,
hit for,
well,
for Disney.
So all they had to do is, that's why they released it. And after they released it again, like you said, in the early 60s, and then again when I went to see it in the early 70s, you definitely got your money back because it was still a big
deal. Well, that's what
deal.
Disney did, though. If people, I don't know if people were aware of this, that, you know, when we were growing up, Disney would make a movie, and then they would wait like 7 years before they would release it again. In this case, it was like eight, but I mean, right in that time period, like with Sleeping Beauty, they did that with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and so you couldn't see a Walt. And this is pre VHS days, so the only time you could see a movie was either on TV or whatever. Of course, they controlled the TV rights because they had their own show, so it was like you had to wait. I remember to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I was in high school when I saw that because I had missed the 7 year marks leading up to it. That's the only way you could see those movies.
The thing is, and I know in modern times, people, you know, there are not all people, but there are people out there that bash a lot of stuff in this modern age of social media. And there's people that go after Walt Disney and not Walt Disney, but Disney now. It's Walt's long gone, we know. But it's one of those things where I'm kind of like, yes, I get part of it. But to just sit there, somebody brings up the name Disney now, and it's just like, and I'm like, you know what? That's ludicrous. There's a lot of great artistry that goes on at Disney Studios, even to this day. Yeah. And back then, and people that would rag on older Disney, I get it. Right after Walt died, we started getting stuff like the Boatniks.
Oh, yeah. No, they went through a really down period there.
$1 million.
Yeah, where the movies were crap. And Super Dad and some of those. It was just awful.
Although I did watch the other day. I did watch That Darn Cat.
Oh, I love that film. No, that was a good film.
It was funny. It kind of surprised me.
It's one of my mom's favorite films by Walt Disney. She loved that movie.
A good cast and everything. Although it was weird to see two gangsters threatening they're going to murder Grayson Hall from Dark Shadows. Right. But the thing is that Disney made many movies.
Oh, yeah.
A re-release of a Walt Disney film was almost like the initial release of another thing. I remember driving near Detroit was it the early to mid 70s? Yeah, early 70s. Yeah, it had to be. We're back to Bogdanovich, and driving down the road, and the movie theater marquee had all the text, but it had two graphics on it. One of them was Paper Moon.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one was Mary Poppins. Yeah. And it was the re-release, and it was as big as any film that was just coming out for the first time that they figured was going to be a hit. Disney has done great stuff. It still continues to do great stuff. If you don't like superhero movies, you know what? It's their time. It's their place. We got our decades of Westerns and musicals and war films and all that kind of stuff. There will be something eventually that I will say this one thing. With the older time periods, you could have a Western playing next to a musical, playing next to a crime film, playing next to a drama, playing next to you could have that. And I like that. But the only reason the superhero films are doing so well now is because people are responding to how well made they are.
Yeah.
There are some that aren't that good. There are some that are only okay. There are a few that stink. There are a lot of them that are really damn good.
Yeah.
There are some of them, and Disney is at the forefront of it. And it's like whoever's at the top, I got to rag on.
Sure.
You know, it's like people ragging on the Beatles. It's like, I don't want to hear it. That's exactly what I mean.
Right.
So, anyway, back to our film. There's a couple of things I want to talk about, and then we need to talk about the squid.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about two moments in the film that I think are sheer poetry. Oddly enough, two shots of the ship. And for some reason at that moment, that to me ranks as pure 100% unadulterated science fiction. Yeah. It is one where the warship is going towards a Nautilus and it's stuck on that reef.
Yes.
And it finally Nemo pulls the Nautilus back and it starts to float back just as that ship is coming towards it. That to me, there's something in that moment that zings me.
Oh, it's a great sequence.
Almost it's just to me, but when I see it I go it isn't a general thing. It's like this weird deep deep feeling that I get when I was like, that is the actual definition of science fiction right there.
Yeah.
A warship is going after something that is fantastical, not understanding, and the thing is backing and getting away from it, and just the weird imagery, which later I would feel a lot the same way. And we can talk about this briefly too later. James Mason being in the ultra brilliant Journey to the Center of the Earth later. I mean, he was almost becoming Mr. Jules Verne there for a while. And the other shot is the explosion of Vulcania when it's blown up and the wave.
Great sequence. Yes. Yes.
And the wave hits the Nautilus and it gets hit by that wave. And I'm like, that once again, that's in the Victorian era, an atomic blast, a blowing up of an island, completely destroying it, and probably all those guys that were trying to attack.
Oh, no, they're all gone. People. Yeah. No, I think that was, that's exactly what they were saying. Yeah.
Yeah, and when he blew that up and that wave, that tsunami basically came and hit the Nautilus for the first time and tilted it and everything like that, and it starts to sink. I'm like, once again, there's that feeling. That's pure science fiction to me. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Let's talk about one of the more famous scenes probably in the film.
Probably the famous scene in the film.
I'd say that the scenes that to me, once again, at the beginning, this is another one of those science fiction moments when the Nautilus is charging and Ned Land is getting ready with that spear.
Oh, that's great.
And you've got the camera tracking. Yeah. You've got the camera.
Great sequence.
I mean, it's way off and it's coming forward and the water spreading in front of the Nautilus with the lights. And this one thing I love, it's at dusk.
Yeah.
And everything. And then finally, when you get to the big close up, they must have had that submarine model on something, and the camera was tracking with it for a few seconds while the water was being spread, and I thought that was beautiful. But anyway, that to me was the first image I saw when they ran that ad back in the early 70s. So I was like blown away by it. But then with this, what we're talking about is the squid sequence.
Yeah.
Once you start.
Well, I think as a kid, and again, I saw it the first time in 63. That's the one that stuck with me the whole way. I mean, in fact, it influenced me so much that I was sort of disappointed when I found out that an actual squid wasn't even near that size. I mean, I know there's supposedly some
there's big
giant
ones,
squids
yeah.
like way in the depths of the Pacific Ocean.
Sure,
but only legendary ones get the size that we see in this one.
Exaggerated by sailors.
Yes, and I do want to put to rest a rumor that this was not the squid that Ed Wood's group stole to make Bride of the Monster. That was another prop from another studio altogether.
It had always been rumored
that it was the squid,
That's an idiot. Some idiot said that. That's. I mean, you can
he
look
stole,
at the
he
one
stole
in the
an
film
octopus,
and go,
not
no
a squid. So anyway. Just,
yeah.
That's
Are you the squid from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? No relation.
No.
But
I thought it was of course we saw that done with Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. The movie had a scene with a big squid grabbing it as well.
They used a real one though. They called it an octosac.
Octosac, that's right.
Which I don't know. Maybe that was one of the variations of
names
that they used.
It could be. I mean, that's how it
is like a living.
That's
sack
how it would propel itself. I mean, if somebody wanted to get technical and say, well, the squid in the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea went backwards. You know, it's not supposed to go that way.
I think the artist knew that, and I think they
didn't
went.
Matter.
If you ever watch them when they're getting away from something, it looks very prissy, like get away from me. And in this case, it was like coming at you with the tentacles. I mean, they did a great job. Here's what I think they did. I think they pulled it real fast, let the tentacles ripple under the water, and then they just reversed it. But that came up with this neat thing where the tentacles were reaching out to the sub.
Yeah, that's what I loved.
And it finally locks onto it. Oh, I think in a way, I thought it was a better choice.
I do too.
We know it's not that. And it locks onto the side of the sub, and they try to electrocute it off the sub, and that isn't working. Then Mason gets his things. You're now going to go up against one of the most tenacious of all sea beasts, or whatever it is. You know, I don't know. I've never tried a James Mason.
He's a hard one to. He's a hard one to do.
So you're telling me I did a bad job?
Well, everybody does a bad job with him. Jim's missing. I mean, it's just, it's hard to do.
Yeah,
it's hard to do. But one fun thing was, you know, originally that scene was going to take place in the daylight.
Oh, I saw photos.
Yeah, from it, and apparently in the daylight, and Fleischer, when he saw it, and Walt Disney saw it, it was like you could see the little gears and the cogs that moved the squids. Yeah. It was like, okay, no, we can't do that. And Walt was the one that came up with the idea. It was like, hey, let's put it in a rainstorm. You know, that'll cover everything up.
It needed to be done.
It made it a better scene. A much better scene in the dark with the rain.
There was no intensity. You had no worry that, I mean, and I know in the book, they just kind of went up in broad daylight with axes. And I think it was a fleet of octopi. If I remember, it was later. In this case, it's even more dangerous because you got guys that could fall in the ocean and drown. Yeah. And, my favorite moment from that is Mason and his guys go up. And Mason's trying to get close enough to put a spear in the critical spot, near the eye. And when the tentacle, which is, they kind of, it's almost sculpted in a way, but it grabs a hold of him and starts dragging him across the deck. And they had that thing bulge in such a way after the end of the tentacles wrapped around him, but the bulge in it gives it that mass of, it's dragging like the muscle inside of, or whatever it would be, is being worked, and it's dragging him across. I'm in a small way when I was looking at one. You know, as rigid and as rough as that damn deck is, I'm surprised he didn't get injured.
I know, the
way that they did it. And then he goes down, and this is one of those moments where we see a glimmer of humanity from Nemo, and that is that Ned Land, who has escaped from his prison cell in this one scene, goes out there, and just his first reaction is, guy's getting pulled underwater, I gotta go save him. And he saves Nemo and brings him back and everything. I will say this, it's one of those things that it was a product of its time, and it reminds me in a way, and I don't think there was any way back then they could have done a better job. I think nowadays they, you know, with whatever abilities we have, it's like brain dead. If you couldn't do that scene, you're an idiot. Back then it was a hard chore.
Yes. Yeah.
And the squid in that one reminds me to a degree of the dated sort of look, not the whole scene, mm-hmm. but some mm-hmm. of it, the dated sort of look of the giant ants in them.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
We got a big thing here where we've got to operate with wires, and it almost became a gag or a joke later in movies. It's like they'd show like a set in a comedy film where they got a giant monster and there's like all these ropes and stuff holding it up, like the Pee-wee's Big Adventure where they're swinging Ghidra back and forth. But I look at it now, and I've heard people say before, well, what they needed to do was bring in Ray Harryhausen. And I'm like, you know what? I don't know if that would have been appropriate. I think that the stop motion animation back then, pre that go motion that put blurs in between stuff, I think it would start to look worse as the years went on. It's no,
yeah, no, I'm sort of glad they didn't do that. I think the practical effect really was the way to go on that. Yeah. I really do.
And I think that, you know, in watching the film over the years, I'm like, because I mean, I saw it one time with a group of young people, and they kind of snickered at the squid. But I'm like, you know, in some ways I can see it, but in some ways, like, there's certain moments of it I think, boy, that's amazing.
So it's still one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. I mean, it's the climactic scene leading up to the end. I mean, it's incredible.
Oh, I mean, there's so many stuff. I didn't realize the budget was $9 million.
That's a massive budget for a film back then. Well, it was such a massive movie that they used three other studios for various locations, you know, and in addition to the, you know, what they did at Walt Disney Studios. And then, of course, they went to the Bahamas to shoot the underwater sequences there, the same place where the 1916 movie was shot, because they loved how clear the water was. They said, yeah, we go back there because that worked so well in that film. They shot it. They shot it Universal International. I forgot a couple of other big studios back then that they leased areas from, like the port that you're talking about there. You know, the beginning where where Kirk Douglas sings his song and stuff, where they're all shipping out. That was shot.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the ones they shot at Universal. The Vulcania set was shot at another studio. So, I mean, that was unheard of for anybody to do pretty much back then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole movie is it's like an open jewelry box from the beginning
Absolutely.
Of the movie starts all the way
Absolutely.
To the end. I mean, even they open up with a book where the
yeah,
pages
yeah,
turn and
yeah.
it's got, I mean, even that's a gorgeous prop and yeah. all that. You get to that one guy, I say there ain't no monster. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, it's I think that when all is said and done, out of the 1950s science fiction, and I'm speaking specifically about that string of films that starts, I guess it does start with The Thing. I mean, technically, the Frankenstein movies and stuff could be considered, they are considered, they're horror films, but they're also considered
science
fiction.
But they came out later. They're like 57, so they're later on.
No, I'm talking about the Universal.
Oh, the Universal ones in the 40s.
Science
yeah,
fiction.
Okay.
But they really, I guess, too much science fiction shape, things to come maybe and stuff like that. But
yeah, yeah.
But then you get to the 50s and you get The Thing and mm-hmm. then Dave Sit Still. Yeah. And then you get George Pal comes in with Destination
right,
Moon
right.
and Forbidden. And then you get Forbidden Planet, you get War of the Worlds, where worlds collide. And you look at all those films and they're all great.
Yeah, yeah.
All of them. I mean, I give them full marks. I really do. And every one of them's in my collection. Yeah. But I have to say that the one that holds up the best visually, and we'll probably get some, you know, maybe we'll get some very true, but I just mean it from the sheer polished and holding up effect. This might be the winner. In that category,
I think it's hard to argue against that. Now, you watch this on an 80-inch screen in Blu-ray quality, right?
So I've
got to ask you, the scene where Kirk Douglas is being chased by the natives off the island, you know, when he is
yes,
there were a lot of gags that were pulled during that scene, actually during the shooting, and many of the cast members mentioned how. The writings, and of course, all of these natives had like tattoos and war paint on them and
right.
stuff like that. And they had a bunch of them had put some humorous sayings on their head. And if you look close enough, and you might be able to do this on your 80-inch screen and freeze frame it, you'll see two natives running after Kirk Douglas. One of them has "Eat It, Joe's" on his head. The guy next to him has something that says "I ate Joe" on his. So I mean, it's a little crap like that you can pick up.
I ate Joe.
Yeah, or you can catch stuff like that nowadays in the high def age. You know, they could get away
There's
with it
so
back
many
then
people,
because you never would have seen
yeah.
it. But even in Cinerama, like you know, they shot this, or in the CinemaScope that they shot this in. But
But that's another thing I wanted to talk about too. You're talking about the CinemaScope. You know, when I was watching it yesterday, I said, you know what, really, for a 1954 movie, this is a very widescreen picture. Now,
it's
I know
the first
they had
one
already
Walt
gone,
Disney ever did in that format in CinemaScope.
Well, I mean, yeah. But the thing is that you started thinking about them fighting back against television and all that stuff. But this movie really is widescreen.
Huge.
I was looking at the black bars at the top and the bottom of my television, and I'm like, boy, this really is a big picture. Another thing,
well,
too,
and for those folks that CinemaScope was the precursor to Cinerama, which actually took three projectors to show in special theaters. This one took special lenses to make it so wide. They actually had to lease the lens that they shot this film in from another studio that had developed the process. I think it was MGM that developed the anamorphic process that they used. Not getting real technical here, folks, but Disney had to invent devices for the theaters to put on their projectors that would be able to handle the widescreen. So that again shows some of the genius behind Walt Disney. And
CinemaScope came out in 1953.
Yep, and this was
so there
this
you
was
go.
Disney's
they
came Disney's in. First CinemaScope film may have been. I couldn't confirm this. It may have been the first CinemaScope, publicly to air. But it's right there, one of the earliest ones.
This is a little bit of a negative.
Uh-oh.
About the movie. Here we go. It's not terrible because it isn't straight through. It isn't the whole movie. Some of the music is excellent. Mm-hmm. Some of it's good, and some of it's a little corny.
It gives away that it's a Walt Disney production. That's another way I can put it. I mean, it's some of it gives it
like
away.
Like when James Mason, they're doing the barrel under the sea, and the guys have gotten on the ship, yeah. and they're, where are we? What is this thing? And they get in there looking out the glass window, and James Mason looks up and sees them in his, you know, main room of the submarine, right. And he goes, "Way!" And then he points, yeah, like, you know, like, "Let's go get them, guys." And then some of the fighting music, they'll stick in the little cue, yeah, part of dun, 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 dun. And it's like a little bit of that. I wish they had been using, you know who I wish had done the score for this movie? Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah.
That would have been, I mean, that's one of the reasons that Journey to the Center of the Earth is so great, is he is so tapped into that Jules Verne. Yeah. Atmosphere. Like I said, the music doesn't stink, but it almost reminds me, it's almost like more in line with something from the 1930s than the 1950s.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that. I mean, there's some really great Walt Disney films that came out that the music sort of gives it away. If you didn't know who made the film, you go, "Oh, that's Walt Disney," because the music gives it away. And that, some of those sections you mentioned, that sort of gives it away a little bit.
Well, during the scenes that I talked about that seem so science fiction to me, where things get really serious or really, you know, downtrodden, he's used those themes earlier in the film, but you get to that part and it's sort of like, oh, now it really works. Or when they play the music, when you first see them under the sea, and they've used it lighter in the film and it's a little too light, but when they get to the undersea scenes and they do their variations on it, it's like, that's perfect.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You got it there. But every once in a while, it's like, let's get back to, you know, Busby Berkeley, you know, kind of thing. I'm a little, you know, and that's a small gripe. I think that's one of the things, you know, that's a little bit of a negative, but not completely. And I forget the name of the guy who did the music.
The music was by Paul Smith, and Joseph Dubin did the orchestration. Paul Smith wrote the music.
Was he known for anything else?
He did music for a lot of animated features. So that's where Walt got him. And that's, you know, they probably just, they did everything in-house. They did a ton of animated music. Well, again, remember, originally this was going to be an animated film. So he probably had already been set up by Walt to do the film, you know, do the music, and just said, "Hey, we'll just keep him on. Even though it's live action, we'll just have him do it."
Now, one of our people that we know personally, Rico Browning worked on this film, the underwater stuff, the suits underwater. Yep. The scene where Ned and Peter Lorre find the sunken ship is real beautiful. The use of the underwater photography is truly amazing and groundbreaking. There was a scene where they had to get the camera in a certain way, and they couldn't. It was like, I think maybe when the sub was going through a cave or something. This is vague, and there's going to be special effects experts that are going to go like, "No, you're an idiot." Well, I'm trying to get this as best I can. They had to use a special lens in order to shoot the sub in that scene. And so what they had to do is the lens was weird and it squeezed.
Oh,
everything.
No, that's no. I know exactly what you're talking about.
They built a
squeezed in
truncated,
a squeezed in sub so that when it was shot, when it was projected in CinemaScope, it would look normal.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Because that was the only way, that was the only way they had to shoot it in 35 millimeter, just straight 35, which would have, you know, made it look stretched out on the screen. So they developed a lens that, and then.
Was this movie shot in 35, the whole movie shot in 35, or was it 70?
It was shot on 35 millimeter film, but using this anamorphic lens that created the CinemaScope effect. So that was the beauty of CinemaScope was, so when it went to movie theaters, all they needed was this special attachment that Walt Disney gave them to create the effect. But the film was actually the same kind of stock that was running in projectors all around the country.
One last, couple little pieces. Well, here's a piece of trivia. One little piece. Charles Grodin was the drummer boy in the movie.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I have to say, this is a pretty amazing film. I am so happy to say that watching, because I watched it, the movie got delivered last year to the house, And I the mailman came up, I snatched his hand and said, give it to me. And my kids were with me. And so we watched it immediately. Yeah. And I enjoyed it. But this time I watched it again, way closer. And I saw so many more details and beautiful moments and beautiful things. And now, like I said, you're telling me that the budget's $9 million. Yep. I still look at it and I go, wow, yep. No wonder. I don't think we saw a movie that would have this sort of, probably not fair to say this. There's probably something I'm missing, but, and I think it was Richard Fleischer, if I'm not mistaken, who directed this one, was Fantastic Voyage. I think we're just about covered it. Yeah. I know there's a billion other things. There's micro details and stuff about the production that we have no clue about what happened. I love the overall fact that it kept Victorian science fiction alive. Yes. I love the fact that we lived in the generation where there was a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea ride to go to at Disney World. I know I'm so grateful for all the designers and everything that show that you can make something that is almost flawless. I mean, a film where so much beauty that is still to this day, you go down to Disney World, they bring out some new 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea product and it sells out faster than you can say Jack Robinson. Absolutely. I know. I mean, I bought some stuff from there that you go in, it's, oh, we just got this in, give it to me. And then, and then you find out later people are, looking for it, So, great film.
Great film from 1954, great film. Folks. And what a way to sort of send off our sixth season and get ready to go into season number 7. I don't think back in 2016, I didn't know if we would be this far along or not with a weekly podcast, but we're still going strong. It's great.
I had complete confidence.
Yeah.
So it was 6 years ago this week that we launched the first episode. And my two in that at episode where decided we were going to try to tackle four films per week or whatever was The Black Scorpion and The Tingler, and yours was War of the Satellites and the Giant Behemoth.
That's right.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It's amazing. I remember what they were. But, we've had a lot of great episodes since then. You've done a lot. There's a lot that you have to do on your own. But you keep on trucking and people seem to love it. We always have a good time when we do the show.
Still growing and we're still getting great fan mail. So, I mean, thanks, guys, for all your support, because we'll keep doing it as long as we can.
Yeah, we're going to, we're going to keep on figuring. I mean, we are moving sometimes into doing movies that are newer than what we had originally planned on. But
we've already started doing that. So a little bit.
Well, we've been doing that for a little while. I mean, we did Superman and Scrooge and Black Hole, which was probably one of the very later ones that we did. But it's. I mean, they're all fun. Once again, another Disney film with a lot of the guys that worked on 20,000 Leagues worked on the Black Hole.
All righty, folks. Thanks for your support. Well, Mark, don't be a stranger. try to get with this a little more often. But I know you've been just going nonstop on the book covers and everything.
It is nuts. It's fun, but it's nuts. I'll try to see. We will discuss what our next episode will be together here in the near future. Cool. But thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday with an all new episode and our first episode in season number 7. So have a great week and we will see you on Monday.
For the past 12 seasons, Mike and Mike have been bringing you a weekly look at all things geek, with reviews, discussions, interviews, and topicals from across the geekosphere. Now, with geek life slowly returning to normal in 2021, join the Earth Station 1 crew as we look at the return of the summer movie season, preview the fall TV lineup, look at all the big conventions now happening, along with other geek topics. You can listen to Earth Station 1 wherever fine podcasts are found, and as always, Earth Station 1 is a founding member of the ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.